So first of all, good evening. I am really delighted to be back teaching and learning with this group. And the game plan for the evening is that I will record the talk, but before we go into the group conversation, I will signal to turn off the mic, just leaving things a little bit freer for the group exploration. So I called tonight's talk Bringing Creativity to Practice. And so you might think that it's somewhat of a good idea to start with some kind of definition of creativity. So I went to the dictionary, and Merriam-Webster, okay, fasten your seatbelts. This is gonna come as a shock. Merriam-Webster defines creativity as the ability to create. So I dug a little further, and the dictionary definition of create was to make or bring something new into existence. So my skeptical synapses just started firing, because do we ever really bring anything new into existence? So as a counterpoint, I'd like to share a little bit of a famous teaching story. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, one of the Pali collections of ancient Buddhist teaching stories. And the story is about the Buddha and what the Buddha said about discovering the Dharma. And when I say Dharma, I really mean the fundamental wisdom of this path, understanding suffering and the end of suffering, that in this tradition is the source of the Buddha's and anyone else's enlightenment. And in this teaching story, what the Buddha says is that discovering the Dharma, the fundamental wisdom, was like coming upon an old abandoned city. So I'll read you a few of the Buddha's words from this text. It is just as if a man traveling along a wilderness track were to see an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by people of former times. He would follow it. Following it, he would see an ancient city, an ancient capital inhabited by people of former times, complete with parks, groves, and ponds, walled, delightful. He would go to address the king or the king's minister, saying, "Sire, you should know that while traveling along a wilderness track, I saw an ancient path. I followed it. I saw an ancient city, an ancient capital, complete with parks, groves, and ponds, walled, delightful. Sire, rebuild that city." So the Buddha is saying that he didn't create the Dharma. He followed a path. He put one foot in front of the other and paid attention to experience as it unfolded. From another tradition, from the Hebrew Bible of my Jewish tradition, in Genesis, God is actually not pictured as creating from scratch. Here's a few lines of basically the first three lines of Genesis, the first three verses of Genesis from a contemporary translation. When God began to create heaven and earth, the earth being unformed and void, with darkness over the surface of the deep, and a wind from God sweeping over the water, God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. So in this teaching story, something exists. There's the earth in chaos, and what the creator deity in this story does is bring order and definition to the chaos. Julia Cameron, who wrote The Artist's Way, which is essentially a manual for supporting the unfolding of the creative process, says that creativity is a spiritual practice. And how I understand what she means is that it's not about I, me, mine. That creativity is not just about some thing that I bring into being, you know, a poem thing or a painting thing. That it's more about being immersed in a process or a practice. Again, walking a path. And for me, in my life, writing poetry is part of my path. And it's true that I do really enjoy the making part, the drafting and the honing and the making it better and the seeing the thing emerge. But at the same time, the more I've walked this path, I've found less of a distinction than I would have thought between crafting my own poetry and, for example, participating in workshops where I also support other writers in refining their work. So here we have Sangha. So I'll just toss out some other qualities that I associate with creativity. And this is not a complete list, and nor is it the case that in any moment or time of creativity that every single one of these qualities has to be present. But this is at least part of the lay of the land. So the ability to recognize possibilities rather than seeing through the lens of limitation. The ability to see beyond fixed assumptions or patterns, you know, filters. Sometimes we see things through a very fixed and limiting lens based on our past experience. In Buddhist practice, we sometimes call those limiting ways of seeing things sankharas. The willingness to immerse in experiential awareness without prejudgment, playfulness, curiosity, the ability to see connections among things, the ability or the willingness to see with new eyes, receptivity, paying close attention, intimacy with experience. So this is the opposite of kind of the top down thinking that my experience is what I think it's supposed to be or what someone has told me my experience should be. This is really getting closer to the feel or the texture of experience. And a sense of awe and astonishment. So right here, we can already see how many of these qualities are qualities of the non-judgmental connected awareness that serves us in Buddhist practice on and off the cushion. So I'm going to read a couple of poems that I think capture at least pieces of this mentality. The first is a short poem by the 19th century American poet Emily Dickinson. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. So the sense of possibility. This poem was published a few years ago by the contemporary American poet Joy Harjo. She has just been named as the next US Poet Laureate, and she's the first Native American person to be a US Poet Laureate. Her poem is called For Keeps. Sun makes the day new. Tiny green plants emerge from earth. Birds are singing the sky into place. There is nowhere else I want to be but here. I lean into the rhythm of your heart to see where it will take us. We gallop into a warm southern wind. I link my legs to yours and we ride together toward the ancient encampment of our relatives. Where have you been, they ask, and what has taken you so long? That night, after eating singing and dancing. We lay together under the stars. We know ourselves to be part of the mystery. It is unspeakable. It is everlasting. It is for keeps. So I'd like to pivot into looking at what does this imply about creativity as a quality of Dharma practice. And you know, it's, I think I've already implied, creativity is not necessarily about doing something new and different. You know, we can practice with a spirit of creativity, whether we're doing traditional meditation practices or we're coming up with new practices of our own. I think that the element of creativity is more about curiosity, fresh, engaged, open, interested, honest attention. So this poem by the contemporary American poet Jane Hirschfield, I think, illustrates a little of that. It's called Secret of Heart. And the epigraph is from the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. What's this? This is an old tool shed. No, this is a great past love. Heart falters, stops before a Chinese cauldron, still good for boiling water. It is one of a dozen or more. It is merely iron. It is merely old. There is much else to see. The few raised marks on its belly are useful to almost no one. Heart looks at it a long time. What do you see? I ask again. But it does not answer. So a world in an old iron cauldron that's just one of many, you know, or the world in a grain of sand. I think that creativity or the creative process is also about the willingness to engage in trial and error, exploration, experimentation, trying things on for size, trusting that we can bring our own discernment to what we're experiencing, you know, that we can try a process, we can try a practice, and that understanding will unfold. So my teacher, Heather Sundberg, who taught here last week, often uses the phrase, trust the unfolding. So let's look now at how, in a more practical way, at how these qualities might manifest in our practice. And I'm going to give two different kinds of examples. The idea of bringing an alive spirit to basic sitting practice, and ways in which practitioners sometimes branch out from the practices they've been taught or that they're used to. So, basic sitting practice. I think anyone who has done sitting practice for more than about a minute has the sense that it can be really rote or it can be nourishing. And inevitably, over time, it's both, not always at the same time. If I were to give a basic description of my own sitting practice, which would basically be a basic description of the practice that we teach and that we offer here, I would say that I sit. I find a position that is both relaxed and alert. That I take the breath as an anchor, meaning that I allow the breath to be at the forefront or foreground of awareness. And that I then open to different experiences that arise. And that I return to the breath when other experiences are no longer predominant. And, you know, that's not untrue, but it's pretty abstract. And I think when we talk about things that way, which we sometimes have to, it sounds like the breath is one thing, that it's a thing and that it's one thing, and that the other experiences that arise, you know, bodily sensation, emotion, thinking are other things. And you know, this can give rise to the sense, to a compartmentalized sense of what our practice is. You know, as if we're keeping a whole bunch of different balls in the air. You know, as if it's a complicated or a busy process. And we sometimes hear this, you know, when we do the beginning class, we sometimes hear this from beginning meditation students, that it seems like there are so many different things that they have to track. You know, now I'm attending to the breath. Now I'm attending to this thing called emotion. Now I'm attending to other bodily sensations. Now I'm attending to this thing called thinking. And at least for me, as you know, as one practitioner, a major aha in my practice was that the words that we use to describe practice are completely different from our actual experience. So when I sit, when I come to sit, and when I sit in meditation, there's a sense of at-homeness. And experience is just what I'm immersed in. So, you know, breathing sensations are known, whether the breath is predominant or whether some other experience, like emotions or physical sensations or thinking, is predominant. Bodily sensations and emotions and thinking are known at the same time that breathing sensations are known. There really aren't all these different kinds of sensations. There's all this sensation. And even when breathing is in the foreground, other sensations and mental experiences are present in awareness. So all there really is sitting and noticing the texture of experience. And we use words like breath and bodily sensation and emotion to isolate out different aspects of experience. And we sometimes have to, I mean, for the sake of teaching or for the sake of sharing our experience. But, you know, what we're really experiencing, we can't even describe. And if we bring fresh, open attention to what is experienced when we sit, we often find that our rich, varied experience doesn't match the words that we use to talk about practice or the words that someone else uses to tell us about practice. Does this match anyone's experience? Is this sounding at all familiar? Yeah, I mean, I think so. And so then the question is, though, what happens when we see this gap or this difference? When I see that, what I'm experiencing isn't what it sounds like when I'm being taught about meditation or when I'm trying to talk about it. Is there a judgment that I must be doing it wrong? Or do I just allow myself to take it all in? Because I think if we can just sit with the feel and the texture of experience as it really is, this is where the opening up and the nourishment and the insight happen. So I also want to discuss ways in which we can bring a creative spirit to practice by modifying or building on the practices we've been taught and that we've worked with, especially when our circumstances change and when the ways that we've been practicing seem less accessible or less fruitful for a while. And one caveat about this, as I said before, there's nothing inherently creative about doing something novel. And particularly for those of us who are Buddhist practitioners, you know, we choose a practice tradition. Many of us have chosen this practice tradition because we have an instinct that those who have walked the path ahead of us have experienced or understood something that we want to understand. So we want to learn from them. And the nature of resistance is that we will give ourselves every excuse in the book to get out from under our disciplined practice when our practice is uncomfortable or when our practice is asking us to see things that we don't want to see. So that's the caution. Yet, at the same time, we're in a practice tradition that says ehipasiko. This is the Pali phrase for come see for yourself. These words are attributed to the Buddha. And this practice tradition, Vipassana, insight meditation, is a tradition that actually invites us to pay very close attention to our experience as we practice and to adjust from moment to moment based on what we experience. You know, not to just proceed or practice in a rote way. You know, otherwise this practice wouldn't be sustainable and it wouldn't be sustaining. So actually, doing this, the paying attention and seeing what is supporting our practice and what has to be adjusted and really doing it in a very alive way is part of the process of investigation that is a core aspect of insight meditation. And actually, for those of us who have heard one or more Dharma talk about the seven factors of enlightenment, investigation is one of the factors of enlightenment. So there's actually a fine line between, on the one hand, doing this process of investigating carefully and discovering for ourselves what works, and on the other hand, thinking that we can invent it from scratch. And actually, for me, the more I want to play around with the shape of my practice, the more I think it might be fruitful to make changes or modify the practices that I was originally taught, the more it seems to help me to be in conversation with a teacher who can give me additional perspective. So that said, wanted to throw out some of the situations in which we might find ourselves drawn to modifying the way we practice. And some of the circumstances that might lead to this include life circumstances that alter the conditions and supports that are available to us. So for example, just very basically, changes in work life or family obligations that might start to make a fixed meditation schedule more difficult. Does this ever happen to anyone? Yeah. So one friend of mine who has done a regular morning sitting practice just for years and years and years has found himself more recently in this situation where personal family obligations make it harder to do that every morning, first thing in the morning sit. And my friend came up with the idea of setting timers to go off throughout the day as reminders to meditate. So basically that way, if he doesn't meditate early in the day, he gets additional chances. So he recognized a reality that in his life, not necessarily forever, but right now, that commitment to everyday early morning practice wasn't happening. But in recognizing it, rather than throwing in the towel or feeling badly about not keeping to the same schedule, he actually took additional steps to make sure that practice continues. I had a long talk yesterday with another Dharma friend, and she's someone who had concluded that for her, regular meditation is not realistic when she's traveling, and she's someone who travels a lot. And for a long time, she held this as a judgment. Not necessarily a judgment that I'm bad, but her judgment was, I don't practice when I travel. And she recently had the experience of traveling to another country during a heat wave. And she noticed that as she was walking around in this discomfort, that she could really note the process of liking and disliking. Preferences, reactions, judgments, reminiscences about times that it was different. And she allowed this process of noting to become a very full practice for her. And she says that she actually came to understand that she had been compartmentalizing her practice. You know, practice takes place on the cushion. And that she was judging that if she wasn't meditating, she wasn't practicing. And once she stopped judging and allowed herself to notice what was actually so, you know, what was actually so was that she didn't meditate a whole lot when she traveled, but once she just allowed herself to notice what was actually so, she also noticed that even though she didn't meditate a lot when she traveled, that she did pay a whole lot of attention to things. And once she noticed this, she could begin to explore ways to continue the strand of practice during her time away from home. And I think in the case of the practices that each of these two friends of mine described, there was this added practice benefit, because engaging in the process of really investing in it, in intention, is very powerful. Intention is a very powerful force in our practice. And they were actually cultivating the attention to the intention to practice mindfully by playing with how can I continue the strand when my circumstances aren't the same. So sometimes our life circumstances interfere not so much with our schedule as with our nervous system's ability to settle. You know, maybe there's an extreme level of activity around us, you know, or because of the particular hands we've been dealt, we're experiencing loss and grief. And it may seem in some of these circumstances like we can't meditate or we don't want to. And for some people, some of the time, the most skillful practice may be to sit anyway and allow ourselves to experience what unsettled feels like. You know, because one experience isn't better than the other, than another. I mean, if we're paying attention to experience, we're not meditating better because the experience that we get to pay attention to is a calm experience, and we're not meditating worse because the experience we're paying attention to is an uncalm experience. So it can feel chaotic and still be practice if we bring awareness to chaotic feelings. Because the experience is, the practice is about experiencing what's there to be experienced. But that is workable for some people some of the time. Sometimes we can't. That is simply true. Sometimes we can't. Or we can, but we get an inkling that the struggle to practice in a particular way at a particular time isn't wholesome for us. You know, perhaps we're cultivating aversion by trying too hard or by practicing with a judgmental mind. Because, you know, I mean, just very obviously, if I'm thinking in terms of, for example, if I'm telling myself that I should be toughing it out, what am I nurturing? Toughness, right? Or in some circumstances, you know, where things have been very disrupted, grief, loss, other kinds of disruptions, we may find out of our discernment and out of our process of paying attention, we may recognize that sitting for a long time with particularly painful or disrupting experiences may sometimes be unhealthy. Sometimes a little goes a long way. Sometimes we learn more and there's more wholeness in just touching into an experience briefly. So in situations like this, practitioners find a variety of ways to maintain a connection to the Dharma. For some people, mindful body-based practices like Qigong, yoga, Tai Chi, which can function very well as a way to settle the system before sitting for some people, or even for a while as an alternative to sitting meditation. What teachers call small moments many times. What if I just sit on the cushion and feel my body and perhaps my emotions and thinking process for a minute or two? And what if I do that again later today and again? Walking meditation, formal or informal. How many people have had instruction at some point in their meditation lives on walking meditation? It's also a formal practice. Uttejaniya, the contemporary Buddhist meditation master who's a teacher of, among others, Steve Armstrong, who has taught here many times, doesn't even talk about walking meditation. He says, take a walk and pay attention. Also, continuing to pay attention in our lives as reactivity and other experiences arise and ebb. Conversation with Dharma friends and teachers about any and all of this. I mean, remembering that it's an eightfold path that kind of consists of three trainings, ethics, mind training, and wisdom. So the cultivation of wisdom is one of the three core trainings. It's not, the Eightfold Path is not only about meditation. If circumstances are suitable, engaging in a little bit of study, remembering and connecting back to the Dharma container, the context in which we're practicing. And, you know, these are just examples. What works for one person at one time isn't going to work for that person at another time, isn't going to work for another person. But the idea is that we can experiment and pay attention to what's happening when we try a new strategy. What's working, what's not working. Keeping in mind that ultimately the point of practice is to cultivate conditions that allow insight into how we lead ourselves into and out of dukkha, which is also translated as suffering, which is also translated as a sense of unsatisfactoriness. And finally, daily life practice also lends itself to creativity and experimentation. So I think a number of people in this room have practiced at times with the five ethical precepts. Some of us have practiced with the paramis, which are 10 perfections, 10 qualities that are very desirable to cultivate, such as virtue, loving kindness, renunciation, equanimity. And in addition to, for example, reciting or chanting the precepts silently or aloud, or reflecting on one or more of the paramis and our relationship to it, some people like to come up with different practices, like, you know, putting post-its around their house, posting the name of the parami, or wise sayings, or writing songs that reinforce the sense of the quality. I mean, it can be anything. The specifics don't matter. And again, doing something novel is not in any way better or more creative than just, you know, practicing a straight traditional practice that's alive for us. The fundamental question is meditation or daily life practice part of a checklist that we have to get through, or is it something we enter into an intimate relationship with? You know, are we genuinely curious, or do we feel we have to do it right? Is it alive for us? Are we willing to enter into a process of trial and error? So before I pivot us into some group conversation, I will end with one more poem by the contemporary poet Linda Pastan, and it's called Imaginary Conversation. You tell me to live each day as if it were my last. This in the kitchen, where before coffee I complain of the day ahead, that obstacle race of minutes and hours, grocery stores and doctors. But why the last, I ask? Why not live each day as if it were the first? All raw astonishment. Eve rubbing her eyes awake that first morning, the sun coming up like an ingenue in the east. You grind the coffee with the small roar of a mind trying to clear itself. I set the table, glance out the window where dew has baptized every living surface. So we're going to pivot into group conversation, and we'll turn off the recorder now.